Tonight on the Daily Debrief, the president's personal attorney is headed to prison. Plus, a husband dead, his wife marries his friend, and the friend is the admitted trigger man.
You and Ms. Williams would have sex up to 15 times a week. You recall ever telling me that?
Tonight, testimony about sex and murder. Also, two nuns, $500,000, and a big plea for forgiveness. That's tonight on the Daily Debrief for Wednesday, December 12th.
Good evening, everybody. Law and politics cross yet again tonight, and the former personal attorney to the President of the United States is headed to prison. A federal judge today sentenced Michael Cohen to 3 years behind bars. Cohen admitted to a series of federal crimes after prosecutors in the Southern District of New York closed in on him. He also assisted to some degree with the investigation by special counsel Robert Mueller into Russian interference with the 2016 presidential campaign. Court documents reveal that Cohen committed four distinct federal crimes: willful tax evasion, making false statements to financial institutions, making illegal campaign contributions, and making false statements to Congress. Prosecutors described Cohen as motivated by personal greed. They added that he repeatedly used his power and influence for deceptive ends. Law and Crime senior editor and former prosecutor Ron Blitzer was in the courthouse for that sentencing. He's on the debrief now to fill us in. So, Ron, federal prosecutors asked for a substantial sentence. Are they pleased with this outcome?
I think they are. Prosecutors with the Southern District of New York were really coming down hard on Michael Cohen. And while they didn't get the maximum amount, which was 5 years and 3 months in prison for their case, they got most of it. And they had even acknowledged that, given Cohen's cooperation with the special counsel's office, that he didn't warrant the max. So they did allow for a moderate variance, as they put it. So I think 3 years is something that they're pretty happy with.
Okay, Cohen somewhat flipped and provided information to Special Prosecutor Mueller. However, the court documents say he's not a true cooperating witness. Was there debate on that in the sentencing hearing today?
There was, mainly between Cohen's attorney and prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. Mueller's office seemed very happy with Cohen, even though he did not sign official cooperating agreements. He did provide what they considered to be credible and reliable and valuable, those are their words, information related to Russia. So they were pretty much glowing about Cohen's cooperation. But as far as the New York side, their team was not happy with him. They said, "We have a strict way of doing business. You sign a cooperation agreement or you don't." Cohen didn't want to do it, and this is why they recommended substantial prison time.
So a bit of disagreement between Mueller's office and the SDNY. That's interesting, because they had been cooperating with one another, I guess one could say, as federal prosecutors leading into this. But look, what do we know today in light of this hearing about the Trump campaign in light of Cohen's cooperation?
Well, we, as the public and the press, don't know a whole lot more, but it seems that Mueller does. As his attorney said in court today, they're keeping their words brief. They're not going into details. They let the court filings do the talking. But the fact that they were this pleased with Cohen's cooperation, that in their brief words today, they highlighted his cooperation, his willingness to account for his crimes, the extent to which he helped them, tells me that there's a lot more that they know.
And Ron, quickly, any reaction from the White House today?
President Trump has been silent throughout the day. Beforehand, he had some harsh words for Michael Cohen, calling him weak for turning on him. Cohen addressed that in court today, saying that Trump is right to call him weak, but not for the reason he claims. He admitted that he himself was weak for blindly following Trump for as long as he did.
So a bit of a backhand for the president from his former attorney. Senior legal editor Ron Blitzer, appreciate the insight on the debrief.
Thank you.
The porn star locked in a lengthy legal battle with President Trump now owes him money. A federal judge has ordered Stormy Daniels to pay the president $293,000. Trump said Daniels was lying about a threatening encounter in 2011. Daniels sued Trump for defamation, but the judge threw out the case and ordered that payment. Opening statements today for a woman on trial over the suspicious disappearance of her husband some 18 years ago. We're calling it the so-called love triangle murder trial. Denise Williams of Florida faces charges for allegedly planning to murder her husband, Mike Williams. Mike had a friend named Brian Winchester. Winchester got on the stand and testified he was the killer. And get this, Winchester later married Denise Williams after the husband, Mike, was out of the way. Here's the backstory. Mike Williams disappeared on a duck hunting trip in the year 2000. Back then, people thought he drowned and maybe was even eaten by alligators. Normally, it takes 5 years for Florida authorities to declare a missing person dead. Denise Williams sought that declaration after only 6 months so that she could collect her husband's life insurance policy valued at $1.75 million. Now, admitted killer Brian Winchester was the man who actually sold some of those life insurance policies while he was having an affair, he says, with defendant Denise Williams. Let's listen to some of the cross-examination.
You started an intense affair, I believe your testimony was, sometime on October 13, 1997 at Floyd's Music Store. Was that your testimony?
Yes, sir.
And that relationship turned into something where you were calling Miss Williams up to 12 times a day, sometimes on the phone?
I'm sure there was a day where I called her 12 times a day, probably, but, I mean, we talked or saw each other routinely, regularly.
During this time frame, where was Miss Williams working?
At first, she was at SBA, State Board of Administration.
She only had a 30-minute lunch break at the State Board, didn't she?
I don't know how long her lunch break was, but she routinely was late getting back from lunch.
Because you previously indicated that you and Miss Williams would have sex up to 15 times a week. You recall ever telling me that?
I gave a range, I believe.
It was 15 the top of the range?
Yes, sir. Maybe. Maybe, I don't know.
You had indicated that the sex acts that took place up to 15 times a week would take place in public places, including the top of the Capitol.
Yes, sir.
And no one ever saw you?
I'm sure people saw us, but we were very good at hiding things. Denise is a very smart person. I'm probably not as smart as her, but we were pretty good at getting away with things.
Okay, sex all over the place, 15 times a week, public places. Look, the cheating was rampant, though. Denise Williams was apparently afraid of divorce, but okay with murder.
You previously testified, I just want to confirm this, you previously testified that Denise Williams didn't want to be a divorcee.
Right.
Except when it came to you. Is that fair to say?
Sure.
You've testified, or you've indicated that part of the reason why you killed Mike Williams is because you wanted to be with Denise Williams. You wanted to be with her romantically.
Yes, sir.
But as it came to pass, after you murdered Mike Williams, you did not, in fact, come to be with Miss Williams exclusively. You were still married to Kathy Thomas, weren't you?
I was still married to her when the murder occurred, yes, sir.
In fact, you didn't get divorced until 2003.
Right.
And then around the same time frame, Miss Williams was involved in a romantic relationship with Charles Bunker.
Okay.
Well, Charles Bunker, you testified yesterday you were aware that Miss Williams and Mr. Bunker went to Atlanta. Do you recall that?
Yes, sir. We talked about it yesterday.
Okay. And you recall that that made you angry?
Yes, sir. I felt very betrayed by that.
Because Mr. Bunker and Miss Williams were in a physical, intimate relationship, weren't they?
At the same time, she was in a physical, intimate relationship with me, right?
All right. So you weren't with her exclusively, and she wasn't with you exclusively, according to your testimony.
We were supposed to be together exclusively, but yes, I cheated on her, and she cheated on me, so we were equal cheaters. Actually, she was first. I forgot.
He had to get that zinger in there. But look, after all these dirty discussions on cross-examination, prosecutors introduced a series of sexual photos.
They're photographs of Denise with my first wife, Kathy, of a sexual nature.
And where were those photographs taken?
Panama City. We traveled together to multiple places, Orlando, Colorado, Panama City. I believe this was after Mike's death occurred,
when?
These pictures.
When was that?
prior to Kathy and I getting divorced, so it would have been between 2000 and 2001.
Sure. Prior to you and Denise coming out as having relations?
A relationship?
Yeah.
Yes, sir. One of these pictures shows it's a spring break. It was a spring break, so I'm guessing.
If I were to tell you that they occurred possibly in April or the springtime of 2000, would that sound right?
It was either 2000 or 2001. I can't remember when Kathy and I separated exactly, but it was 2000 or 2001.
Regardless, they were prior to you and Denise making your relationship public, correct?
Yes, sir.
On the debrief is attorney and former prosecutor Francie Hakes. Francie, good to see you again.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks to be here.
Okay, so look, here's what I'm trying to get at with this. Jurors are listening to all of this. You know, this guy's having sex with this woman, the defendant. You know, his wife is in the picture. This is all rolled up together. Jurors need to figure out whether Denise Williams is guilty of murder, and she's not the one that pulled the trigger. She wasn't even present there. So how do they get to that when they're caught up in all of these other details about the relationships?
Well, it's really difficult, actually, Aaron, because I think in this case, this witness has given the defense a real opportunity, and that is he has expressed his anger and disdain at the defendant for, quote, cheating on him, a married man. So you have to wonder whether the defense is then going to be able to argue that he implicated her in this murder that he clearly had a motive for all on his own, that is, he desired her. So he implicated her just out of anger or some sort of vengeance.
Yeah, to try to save his own hide, because, of course, the defense here is, look, there's this big immunity agreement. He can sit up there and say whatever he wants if it's in the confines of that agreement, because the bottom line is he's not going to get in trouble for a lot of it at this point. And surely that's going to have to resonate with jurors. We're going to get to that in a couple of minutes, Francie. We'll check in with you again at the end of the broadcast here. But I want to move forward now. Tonight on The Debrief, still ahead, we are going to show you something you don't see every day. Prosecutors getting quite the shock when a convict lunges across the courtroom after learning his fate. Find out what led to that altercation when we return. You're watching The Daily Debrief. We'll be back to the Denise Williams case in just a second, but first, Anthony Velez with other crimes making headlines.
Here are today's top crime stories trending on LawAndCrime.com and across the country. Two nuns in Southern California are in hot holy water after reportedly stealing nearly $500,000 from a Catholic school to fund their lavish lifestyles, including flights to Las Vegas to gamble. The two nuns with an alleged bad habit for embezzling money, Sister Mary Margaret Cooper and Sister Lana Chang, reportedly misused the funds prior to retiring from the St. James Catholic School. A routine audit following the retirement of Sister Mary Margaret raised red flags before the two nuns hit the confessional and admitted to their wrongdoing, reportedly begging for forgiveness. The Los Angeles Archdiocese declined to press criminal charges, and the nuns will face sanctions to be determined. The lead guitarist for death metal band Cannibal Corpse was arrested in Florida after his home caught fire and ammunition exploded. 53-year-old Pat O'Brien is accused of entering a neighbor's home without permission and refused to leave before he allegedly assaulted a woman during the fire. Deputies reportedly found O'Brien hiding near a fence near his property, and he allegedly charged at responding officers with a knife before being subdued. O'Brien now faces charges of burglary of an occupied dwelling and assault charges. A convicted child abuser lunged at prosecutors in Las Vegas after learning his sentence. Terhane Woods, who was found guilty of beating a 13-month-old boy, lost his cool after finding out he was sentenced to 9 to 23 years in prison. Woods reportedly acted out throughout the trial. Those were today's top crime stories. I'm Anthony Velez for Law and Crime.
Now back to the Denise Williams trial and critical testimony from the lover, the alleged accomplice, Brian Winchester. Let's listen once again to where he admits to shooting and killing the victim. This witness testified that he started by pushing the victim into the lake. We're going to listen now to his lengthy description in its entirety.
So he was in the water, and he was
like struggling, and the motor of the boat was still running, and I pulled off just a little bit to get kind of away from him so that he couldn't reach back into the boat. And I didn't know it at the time. I didn't know if he was trying to swim, or I didn't know what was going on, but what I came to find out, or eventually realized, was he was taking the waders and the jacket off. And he got those off, and I think I forgot to tell you about this part before, but I remember now that area of the lake had a lot of snags, a lot of dead trees that come up out of the water, and there's a lot of stumps that come up out of the water. And he swam over to one of those stumps and held on to it. And he was panicking, and I was panicking, and none of this was like going how I thought it was going to go. And I didn't know what to do. But he started to yell. And I didn't know how to get out of that situation. And so I had my gun in the boat. And so I loaded my gun, and I made one or two circles around, and I ended up circling closer towards him. And he was in the water. And as I passed by, I shot him.
Where did you shoot him?
In the head. So when I shot him, it was dark. And there was a bright flash when that happened. And I didn't want to see what happened. So, like, I closed my eyes when the instant of that flash happened. And the boat was moving as this happened. And so I turned back around and came back to where he was. And got to the stump. And I knew I couldn't leave him there being shot. So I was going to have to do something to cover this up.
That trigger man said he only picked up secondhand tidbits of what his lover Denise Williams was doing after her husband's death. Here the prosecutor interrupts testimony to drive home the point that it was this witness's plan with Denise to kill her husband.
We had prearranged that obviously our communication needed to be minimal, both by phone and in person. Obviously, we weren't going to be meeting up in parking lots and having sex and doing all that was normal for us to be doing. Denise kind of sequestered herself up in her bedroom and didn't want to be around a lot of people during that time, which was smart of her to do. And so I got a lot of information from Kathy, but eventually, you know, she and I talked. And there never was a conversation that was like, well, did it all go according to plan? Or, you know, first of all, I didn't want to talk about that because that was not the plan. What happened with Mike was not the plan that Denise and I had come up with.
Let me stop you right there. I want to make it clear. The plan didn't play out the way you wanted to, but it certainly was it the plan that you and Denise had discussed to actually have him killed.
The plan was for his death to occur, but it was not for it to occur in the way that it did. I mean, the plan was for him to fall in the water and for him to have a chance to survive it. But obviously that's not what happened, and I didn't want to tell Denise that.
So the killer and the lover finally turned their attention towards the money.
She assumed that what we talked about, the plan that we had made, she assumed that that was what had happened. It wasn't until years later that I tried to and somewhat told her that that's not what ended up happening.
Okay. So at some point you and her started talking again despite the distances. When was that?
The first time, I'd be guessing. I mean, I would say a few days before we talked. I'm sure the first time we talked was just on the phone. It was a little while before I saw her in person because I remember being kind of nervous, I just knew it would be weird to see her because of what we had done. I just knew it would be weird to see her after that, kind of to face each other after that. The concern between she and I then became, well, if his body's not found, what's going to happen with the life insurance?
And that seems to be the big question here. Back to Francie Hakes one last time, former prosecutor, current defense attorney. Francie, should we trust this witness or should we listen to the defense for Denise Williams, who said at the beginning of this case, look, you pretty much have one question. You need to determine whether to trust this key witness or to think he's a liar.
Well, it's interesting, Aaron. First, I'm not a defense attorney, but I'm about to sound like one. And I can't believe it because I'm an old prosecutor. I can't believe I'm going to sound like a defense attorney. But this witness is full of excuses for why there is no evidence of this collusion, why there's no physical evidence of it. He's telling us all the things that people normally do not manage to do in these kind of schemes, and that is to keep away from each other and to keep from putting these kind of discussions on any kind of digital media. I find it a little bit hard to credit.
Well, you know, one thing that prosecutors did say is, hey, look, this happened way back in the year 2000, where there weren't as many text messages. By the time we thought that this was a murder, the paper trail, if there was one, was long gone.
I think it plays in the defense's hands. Whether it's true or not, what he's saying, it plays into Denise Williams' hands that there isn't that kind of evidence. And so basically, the jury is going to have to believe this witness, this murdering, self-described killer. They're going to have to just believe him.
It all hangs on him. Francie, I've got to say goodbye to you. We're out of time tonight. I appreciate your insight, as always.
My pleasure.
All right. That's all the time we have, as I said, for the debrief. I'll see you back here tomorrow. Our live coverage of this trial picks up at 9 a.m. See you then.